You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. We've got interviews today with debut novelist Jennifer Wallace talking about her novel Digging Up Milton and Emily Winslow talking about her memoir Jane Doe January. My studio guest is novelist, author and poet Elizabeth Speller. We'll be drilling down into all those different aspects of Elizabeth's writing career. But what strikes me about Jennifer's work and about Emily's work, as we'll hear from both of them, is how they are inspired by real life events. And you yourself, Elizabeth, have used real life events to inspire you.
That's certainly the case. I think I'm very surprised to find myself writing, in effect, as a man. My first person is a man, and about war, because I can't fire a gun. I'm clearly not a man. But I did grow up and spent my childhood in a period of sort of very conscious of the Vietnam War was going. There were protest marches. I was actually at school and my mother wasn't going to let me go, but I did actually play truant to go on protest marches. So it's tremendously the whole issue of war. It was and is now.
And you used some of your family history and at Break of Day, didn't you, your third novel?
I did. I mean, I used one fairly close. My grandfather, who was a bit of a rogue, had gone to America in the early part of the 20th century, and he was settled. They had a very nice time. He'd made quite a lot of money. He'd never changed nationality. And when the war broke out, he got his papers. So he had to decide, you know, would he go back to England, which he'd long left, and fight for that country, or could he hide in, well, stay in America? And so the decision he made is quite similar to one of my characters.
And you had paperwork and records.
I had amazing things. I had the saddest little diary of a sort of spinster great aunt, and she did seem to do nothing with her life. She just stayed at home and sewed things. And there, in this little prayer book, she's written about the death of her brother in the Somme, and it goes round and round the page, saying at 11:45, Rupert died, an officer and a gentleman. And it's just so sad, this little writing. And she kept his photograph by her bed all her life with a poppy in it. So, yes.
And more up to date, you've also written about the suicide of your nephew, haven't you? Which has had amazing consequences. Tell me about that.
That was strange, because I'd written my first book, my first novel, The Return of Captain John Emmett, a suicide. It was about whether a death was a suicide or a murder. So I wrote about suicide, thought about it. And I'd written a memoir about my family, who were quite eccentric, lots of writers and artists, saying, well, you know, some of them are clearly mad, but nobody had ever killed themselves. After that, my nephew, who was 21 years old, killed himself in our, we thought, very happy family. And for a while, I couldn't write at all. I think, well, what am I doing? I'm just writing things I'm making up. They're just stories. And this is what it's actually like. You have, in the middle of your family, this terribly sad death. And so everybody you love is you know, terribly distressed, including my, you know, elderly father, my brother's sisters. But actually, I didn't feel, in the long run, I thought, no, I got it right about the death of the man in my book. And writing is one way I would make sense of life, things like that.
And your brother used what you'd written to, as almost not like, not a platform, but it certainly worked as a springboard a little bit.
Well, he's amazing.
Don't worry, we shall change your headphones in just a moment. Elizabeth, battling with headphones.
He's amazing. I mean, he after a period, of course, being completely adrift, he had four sons. This was his third son. He now is a spokesman. I mean, you see him everywhere. You Google his name. I mean, he's on television. He goes around the world talking about it. He did a wonderful TED talk, which I went with him to support him, and he ended in tears. But he got a standing ovation, talking about trying to prevent young men in particular killing themselves, which sadly young men die more from suicide than any other cause of death, which is extraordinary, even motor accidents.
What is your brother's name, if people want to find?
It's Richard Moore, and he goes around. He comes from Cambridge Colleges. He was already trained. He was a headmaster, and he then trained in mental health. And so when this happened, The irony was all these pupils had been taught by him who loved him terribly. His other sons, fine. And then he had to cope with this. It wasn't that we didn't see it coming. It was clear things were going badly wrong. But he's, you know, now worldwide talking about it, and I think making a big difference about what he always says is coping with failure, that everybody has to fail. Anyone can cope with success. But how do you teach your children to accept failure, break down relationships and so on?
Wow, big stuff. So Richard Moore TED Talks, we want to find out more about that. We're going to play your first track now, which is not the most cheery of tracks, but you are a very cheery person, as we'll find out. That's Barry Maguire, Eve of Destruction. Why this one?
Simply because when I was a young teenager, there were two lots of songs. One was about people dying in motorbike accidents, like Terry and Leader of the Pack, and the other was about us all dying in a sort of post-war apocalypse. So that was the sort of background to me growing up. I could have chosen one of many, but this one I think is... I mean, they are funny. They are true, but they are now quite funny. They're of their time.
Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save. We're the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy.
That's Eve of Destruction by Barry Maguire, the first choice of my studio guest today on Bookmark. Now with new headphones and comfortably settled, Elizabeth Speller. Elizabeth is the author of three novels and four non-fiction books. Her first novel, The Return of Captain John Emmett, was published in 2010 and chosen as a Richard and Judy Summer Pick, the Orange New Writers Book of the Month, and shortlisted for the Waverton Goodreads Award. Her second novel, The Strange Fate of Kitty Easton, was published in 2011, and her latest, At Break of Day, came out in 2013. Her non-fiction work includes Following Hadrian, a reconstruction of the Emperor's travels, City Guides to Athens and Rome, and a memoir of her family entitled The Sunlight on the Garden. She also writes poetry and was a recent winner in the prestigious Bridport Poetry Competition. Elizabeth Speller, you are a very busy writer indeed. Which one of those, non-fiction, fiction or poetry, are you most comfortable with? How would you define yourself?
I think I define myself as a writer. Actually, I don't see the lines between the genre, like everyone else says, are you, you know, this is our non-fiction course or this is a fiction book. Because actually I made up, I even when I did postgraduate work, I made up quite a lot of it. It's sort of... You're trying to have a sense of place, and that might be a city, it might be in time, it might be something based in poetry, more abstract. But I think it's just I like the memoir. Captain Emmett was a thing which is about execution of our own soldiers in the war. As an issue I wanted to look at, and the effect of something terrible, how the ripples move outwards. That then, of course, my most recent book is the closest in my head. So,
do you switch between the two? Do you have things? Are you writing some poems while you're doing non-fiction?
No, I write poems when things are going wrong. I write poems in certain moods. You know, like it's a sort of a very contemplative thing. And sometimes I can write lots, and sometimes I go a year and nothing. I couldn't write poems any more than I could do physics. But then when I am in the mood, it's great.
And we talked, may mention that your first book was a Richard and Judy Summer Pick. What impact did that have as on a first novel being highlighted in that way?
It was absolutely extraordinary. I think I sold in the next week more books than I've sold, certainly in England, of all my books put together.
The next week after it had been named as a
after
Richard.
It had been named and after I did the interview. And suddenly, you know, your publishers and your agent really love you and they're ringing you up all the time. My books sell well in other countries and America, obviously, just lots of people, so they sell. But it was extraordinary. It was amazing. I mean, the whole Richard and Judy experience is quite amazing.
I'm imagining that. Yeah. And they're all set in the past. Obviously, and they're all around a similar kind of period, really. You're obviously drawn to that period. It's pre-First World War, during the First World War, and post.
I am. I mean, actually, at the minute, I'm just finishing a novel, a rather overdue novel, which is set in the late 60s. So in the Cold War, still war, I must be. I've got stuck somewhere. Because I think I've sort of said everything I need to say about the 1920s, really. But I am. I think partly because I had family material, partly when I was doing postgraduate work, I looked at a lot of letters and I just thought it was much better as a story. You find out the things you think, I'll have to put footnotes. Yeah, I can make more up. So
I suppose it is a time of great change as well and a pivotal point, really.
I think also, you know, you think, oh, the First World War was a very bad thing. A lot of people died. Of course, that's true. But for women, for technology, for medicine, engineering, and music and film, it was a huge acceleration in culture in many other ways. But nearly a million men died. I mean, in Britain, I mean, much less worldwide. I think it's 32 million.
It's and at break of day, you are counting down, really, to that big battle of the Somme where, how many, was it a million men died?
There were 60,000 casualties on the first day, and that's dead and injured. But, I mean, the British and Empire troops. But I think the sad thing was that when that news started to filter through, particularly to the north, where they'd taken these really bad losses, they knew it couldn't be true because there was no way that many people could die. They had no idea that two machine guns and a crossfire could take out a regiment as it tried to, you know, take out a... that was so sad that they couldn't encompass how it could have happened. And yet they could hear, in London and Dublin, you could hear the bombs and you could hear the guns. As you walked around Piccadilly, you could hear what was going on the Somme, which is extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. You tell the battle, really, through the lives of four men whose lives converge at various points in the countdown to the Somme. How did you choose those characters? They're four very different characters.
I chose... one of them, as I say, was slightly based on my grandfather, who did make the decision to come home, as my man does, and fight for the country he grew up in. One was sort of based on my son. I have a son who keeps lists about cars, mostly, and girlfriends, it used to be, and aims and ambitions, and he has two notebooks. The other one, at one point at university, he had one, Money People Owe Me, and I did suggest that wasn't going to make him terribly popular if you get this little book. But so I have Frank, who's an ordinary, and he's sort of every man. He knows, he goes, he has to do it, and he makes lists. When he gets stressed, he makes lots of lists about whatever he wants to. Before the war, it's about the bicycles he wants, like the cars, my son, or the qualities he needs in a wife. And then he goes on to sort of wartime lists, which help him
to control him,
to control his environment, because he has none. He's a soldier. He does what he's told. The only thing is he's always wanted a bicycle and he joins the bicycle corps. So he's got a bicycle. And that's, until the war, had been his main ambition. So he succeeded. One of them was very much based on Ivor Gurney, the poet, who is an organist at Gloucester Cathedral, is clearly unsuitable, really, to fight. And he has synesthesia, which I find very hard to say, which is where you have that crossing of senses. So you see sound in colour, or sometimes you see words in colour.
That's lovely, the bits you describe. I'm listening to organ music and clouds of different colours.
Yeah. And that, you know, people like Kandinsky and various musicians have had that. And now there's, of course, now with brain scans, you can tell how it happens. But then it was probably thought to be just neurotic. And I suddenly thought, well, if you went to war where you're with noise all the time, is it hell or does it create something else? So I was fascinated to sort of follow that and think how he would cope, a man who just liked beauty and was worried about his own sexuality. And because I think you think, oh, everyone at that period is all thinking the same thing and they're all like this. But they are no more than we are, homogenous. Some people are patriotic, some people are cross, some people are terrified. And I like him, though. I'm rather fond of him. And then I had a French boy, because again I thought, well, you know, we all know the Somme, but people were living there. They were just living fairly peasant lives. They'd lived for hundreds of years, farming, simple. And then suddenly you find you're middle of where the world's decided to have its biggest war. Except within when I did research, I found that actually Agincourt was there too. There'd been Battle of Crecy was there. It's a natural meeting place, sadly.
Yeah, it's a lovely book, the way their lives intertwine and as I say, cross-section and bump off each other. You're counting down really to the Battle of the Somme.
Yes.
Quite well-worn territory in many ways.
Yes.
You knew that. So how do you make it different?
I think, that's probably why I wouldn't write any more now, because when I started, it was really nice because I knew much more about it than anybody except military historians. Now I don't, because we've had the centenary. But of course, the centenary of the Somme is a couple of weeks off, 10 days. It's 1st of July. So I'm sure there'll be another little sort of spout. I think I did nod to it on my first page about the larks and things that other people have mentioned, because sort of knowingly. But the bit I did have, which I think others don't, was that it was all filmed because it was going to be a great victory. And it was the first time they'd ever tried filming. So they had a couple who went out, who were made officers. They were filming, a senior officer and a junior officer. And they went out and filmed the whole thing. And it was, for most people, it was the first film they'd ever seen. It went back to Britain, it went back to the States. Somebody played the piano, they did in those days. But of course, what they saw was terrible, really. And there were various bishops, various people said it shouldn't be shown. And then for a long period, it was thought to be possibly that a lot of it had been faked. And then in Canada, they got better with lip reading. And they say most of it wasn't. There were a couple of things they'd repeated. But they managed to read what they were saying. And there was one where they're standing there together, and one said, "Where the hell are we?" And the other one goes, "Where the hell are we supposed to be?" and they analysed and said, "No,
wow."
So I thought that was just a nice thing, 'cause that's modern film.
That's those words travelling through the decades as well.
Yeah.
Well, we will come back to that amazing book. We'll take a slight diversion further back into the past as we hear from Jennifer Wallace. Jennifer is a lecturer and director of studies in English at Peterhouse College, Cambridge. She's written and edited many books on literature and the Romantic poets, but her first novel, Digging Up Milton, was published earlier this year by Killiam Press. I asked Jennifer to tell me about it.
Digging Up Milton is based on the true story of the people in the East End of London who discovered that the poet Milton was buried in their church, and they couldn't resist the temptation to investigate, and they unearthed his coffin and opened it up and found the body of Milton inside. And according to this pamphlet which I found, they then actually cut bits of Milton up and sold the bits on the black market, or sold the bits as souvenirs or relics.
It's very grisly. Why did they do that?
Well, this is what intrigued me. I mean, there's no indication in the pamphlet about motivation, so that was why I was inspired to write the novel, to investigate it in fictional form. I think that they were partly motivated by the money. These were poor people who did it, pawnbrokers, coffin makers, grave diggers, just the local people in the area, and they sold bits for sixpence. This is a time when Milton was enjoying a kind of renaissance. This was just before Britain went to war with France. Milton was seen as this patriotic bard from the previous century, someone who had a kind of moral authority that they might have responded to. And even if I think they didn't necessarily read him themselves, they were attracted to that sense of his aura as a famous poet. So in the novel, I'm kind of interested in how much it's about his fame, his politics, the kind of respect that they had for a great poet, and the pride they might have felt that the poet was buried in their parish and they had a little piece of him.
It's not a very well-known story. How did you come across it?
I came across it because I wrote a book on archaeology a few years ago and was investigating the ways in which archaeologists are interested in digging up bodies, and came across this pamphlet then. And I was intrigued because the pamphlet stops kind of halfway through the story. The person who wrote the pamphlet had bought a few pieces of Milton as part of his so-called research.
He'd actually got genuine bits of Milton.
Yes, he bought a bit of bone and a bit of skull and some hair, and he did this, as he said, in order to try and restore these pieces to the grave and to research what was going on. But there's no indication that they were restored to the grave, and so I was intrigued about the fact that there might actually still be little pieces of Milton undeclared but floating around.
And when you read this pamphlet, did you think, right, that's it, I've got to write a novel about this? Because this is your first novel.
I did. I had this story burning away for a number of years. And so then I finally got the space to be able to write it.
And it's set in 18th century London. It's very atmospheric and you use similar language to novels of that period. Is that your area of expertise or did you have to research that?
I am a romanticist, as so I specialise in literature of that period, 1790 to 1830. This is the time of the poets like Wordsworth and Coleridge, Keats, Shelley. So this is a period that I thought I knew well. I knew what the poets wrote about it. But when you start to write a novel, you realise all the things that you don't necessarily know as a literary critic, like what did people eat for breakfast in those days? What were the inside of their houses like? What was the lifestyle of an ordinary housewife having to go to the market? And these sort of things aren't really covered by the poets. So I did have to research that a bit. My difficulty was that the narrator of the story, Lizzie Grant, who's a working class woman who in my rendition, she can't read or write. She's illiterate, but she's very good at maths. She's very clever. My difficulty was that there aren't many examples of that kind of writer in the 18th century. So trying to create her voice and her perspective was more difficult to research and to imagine. But gradually I read things like Moll Flanders, Fanny Hill, Mary Wollstonecraft, who wrote about the perspectives of women in the 1790s. So gradually a kind of amalgamation of all these female voices, some of them actually written by men in the 18th century, gelled. So I developed Lizzie's voice. I mean, the other thing I found was that when you're trying to do research for a historical novel, there's only so much research you can do. You don't want to make it top heavy with facts and stuff. So at a certain point, research has to stop and imagination has to take over.
And you've written it in a similar style to novels during that period, but it's what you take from the novels during that period, how you do that style, because you don't want it to be off-putting, because some of those novels, they're classics, but they can be quite hard work.
Yes, no, exactly. I had to make it accessible to the reader, but also have a kind of sense of the 18th century style, particularly someone like Laurence Sterne, is extremely kind of gushy. There's a sort of real drive and momentum about the rhythm of the sentences, and so I was trying to capture that this was a woman's voice telling the story.
And you talked about the problems of finding a woman's voice, but obviously it was very important to you that you persevered with that. You really wanted a female protagonist.
Yes, this character, Elizabeth Grant, is mentioned in the pamphlet. She actually stood guard over the body, or stood guard in the church, and allowed people to come and view the body for sixpence a time. But that's all that the pamphlet said. And I thought, what an amazing character. Who was this person? I wonder how she felt about the body that she was guarding.
And getting back to the times where that was quite normal to go and look at a dead body, and where it was a little unusual to dig it up and carve it into pieces, but certainly nobody would do that now.
No, I mean, this was a period where people would go and watch public executions. It was also a period when there was body snatching going on. People were needing bodies for dissection in the medical schools. So I think perhaps there was less of a taboo about it than there is now. But I think also the difference is, and this is what interested me, it's different when you look at any dead body and when you look at the body of Milton. Actually, in the course of the novel, there's a further investigation about whether this was in fact Milton or whether it was just some ordinary person. And at that point, the price of the relics are liable to drop.
Have you used the novel to reflect back on Milton's works and the things that he was saying?
The novel is structured into 12 chapters, which actually reflect the 12 books of Paradise Lost, which is the great poem that Milton wrote. And the poem Paradise Lost is all about Adam and Eve eating the fruit from the tree and then falling from innocence into sin or experience and being banished from heaven into earth. So that idea about temptation, guilt and fall, I felt was latently present in this novel, in which these people began their lives in a kind of innocence. It's about the repercussion of the violation of Milton's body. So in a way, they go through a kind of Miltonic fall themselves. you might think that this is a paradise lost for everyone.
It's quite a challenge for a first novel. You're setting it in the past. You've got a heroine, and as you're saying, it's difficult to find female voices from that period. And you're trying to tap into themes that Milton wrote about. It's very ambitious.
Yes, it took me a little while. There were many versions that I wrote because it was my first novel. But I also tried to make it fairly simple so that you can read it whether you know Milton or not. You can read it on a number of different levels. One of the chapters, Lizzie, tries to find out more about Milton. So you can learn a little bit about Milton as Lizzie learns about him too.
What did you learn most in the process of writing the first novel?
I learnt some of the kind of techniques of narrative, which you only really learn when you write one, rather than, even though, you know, I've studied the novel over many years and taught it, I learnt about timing. I wrote timelines to work out day by day what my character was doing. I drew maps to work out how she could walk from one place to the next. And I learnt about how to develop a voice. And I also learnt, which people always say, and you think it's a cliche, but it's true that as you write fiction, the characters start to write themselves. The story develops in ways that I hadn't actually planned consciously, but you finish a page in a place completely different from how you began a page.
So has it whetted your appetite? Will there be another one?
I'd like to write more novels, yes. I've got a couple of ideas, so I need to find the space and time to develop them.
And what about Milton's bones, just to return to that finally? What do you think happened to them? What happened to his body? Is he reburied there? What's under that earth?
If you go to St Giles Cripplegate Church, which is the church in the middle of the Barbican, it's the one building there that survived the bombing in the Second World War, and you can see there a plaque saying, you know, near here Milton was buried. There's no mention in the church of him being dug up again. There are various mentions by the poets of Milton's hair, which continued to circulate in the more literary classes. Keats wrote a poem on seeing a lock of Milton's hair. This was a lock that was owned by his friend Lee Hunt, who had got it from a surgeon called Dr. Batty, who actually makes an appearance towards the end of my novel. And that lock of hair can now be seen in the Keats Shelley Museum in Rome. Somehow Robert Browning acquired it, gave it to his wife, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, and now it's held in a little reliquary with Elizabeth Barrett Browning's hair, the two locks together, Milton and Elizabeth's, in the Keats Shelley house in Rome.
So there is something of him left, we think.
Yes, some bits. But what happened to the bones? There's no substantial evidence. So I like to think that maybe someone has a little piece of Milton's bone, but it's somehow less acceptable to have a bit of bone than it is to have a bit of hair. So it's not quite so publicly displayed or written about in poetry.
That's Jennifer Wallace there talking about her debut novel, Digging Up Milton. And I'd just like to thank Jennifer because she was battling with a throat infection there. So, but she persevered, thankfully. And you're back listening to Bookmark with my studio guest, Elizabeth Speller. Elizabeth, you were listening to that and you were nodding there when Jennifer was talking about research and saying there's only so much research you can do.
I think it's a fantastic snare. Now that, especially now we have the internet, you know, you don't have to go out in the rain to the library. You can actually, and you can find out everything. I discovered that one of the reasons hairstyles officers changed was because they liked wearing violet hair cream, but the rats liked to lick violet hair cream. So the sleek look you got at the beginning of the war, which is with violet pomade, has gone later because they get, and the rats aren't biting them. They just don't want to wake up being licked by rats. And you I have to get that
You've
in.
You've got to get that in, yeah.
But I didn't. I mean, but you know too much. And I did go on a panel with Alan Honninghurst, and he said, and he'd written a book about the First World War, The Stranger's Child, and he said, oh, no, I don't do any. He said, it spoils the novel. I write the novel, and then I look up the plotting out, and I went home, and actually, I thought there's a lesson there. He said, you've got to get your actual novel structure.
And do you also agree with Jennifer on that point she was saying about, she said, you know, it's just a cliche, but it's true that the characters take over, they take you somewhere you didn't think you were going.
It's really hard because I always think when you say that, it sounds really pretentious, and yet it's absolutely true. Like, you think X will be in love with so-and-so, and these two will hate each other, and they clearly don't, and the character was going to be subsidiary. I have one in my book who I actually like better than my main characters, you know, and he comes forward. You think, no, you're a subsidiary character. You've got to stay there. So, yes, they do. They do. I mean, they're like people, they do things that you don't expect. It's quite fun. I heard somebody on the radio the other day talking on a book programme, and they said, well, do you have the timeline? Do you know exactly what's going to happen? And he said, oh, I couldn't be bothered to write the novel if I knew how it was going to end.
Yes, yeah, so lots of writers say that. Yes, where's the fun in that?
Yeah, where's the fun in that? That's sort of, you know, that's like a PhD.
Yeah. Well, we're going to listen to your second choice of music now, rather appropriately, given what we've just been talking about. Keep the Home Fires Burning, John McCormack. Why this one?
This is a 1915 recording. So it was just about the most popular song in the First World War, and it was written by Ivan Novello. Ivan Novello was actually called David Davis, and he was an organ scholar at Gloucester Cathedral with my fictional character. I mean, Novello was, for real, my fictional character, clearly not. But so there's that link. And he was an organ scholar who went to London, got in with the high life. He wrote this song, seeing war coming. And there's certainly several letters and suggestions that he was then longing for war to start because he knew the song had got something, but people had to be fighting first and going away. And there was still peace. But also he did become a pilot. He was quite brave, Ivan Novello, when he did his bit, as they would have said then.
There were some on the from the hillside, they were called in from the glen, and the country found them ready at the stirring call for men. Let no tears add to their hardships as the soldiers pass along, and although your heart is breaking, make it sing this cheery song. Keep the home fires burning while your hearts are young.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Bit of an Ivan Novello, Bell and Sebastian mashup there. We were listening to John McCormack, Keep the Home Fires Burning, which is the second choice of music from our studio guest today on Bookmark, Elizabeth Speller. And Elizabeth, you're going to read an extract of your work now.
Right, well, this comes from At Break of Day, which is my most recent completed novel. And this is one of Frank. I mentioned Frank before. He's every man. And he's a cycling messenger. They had a cycling corps. They sent them to the Somme, which was just full of mud. And these cyclists, it was a terrible offence to leave your bicycle, but you couldn't really get anywhere. So all his joy of having a bicycle slowly filters away. But this is his thoughts on the different sorts of signalling, because signalling in war is very important. So this is one of his lists, I guess. The order of signalling usefulness went like this. 1. Linesmen. They mostly ran, squatted or crawled through the mud, rolling their drums before them, and they were top of the heap because they are modern warfare. And they know how to fasten the wires up to field telephones at each end. 2. Signallers had lanterns, and they knew Morse, and they liked to practice it with each other for a laugh, like, your girl's off with a sailor, and I've pissed in Spook's water bottle. Very, very funny, they thought they were. 3. The flagmen stood on a hill and waved their flags, but the signals were read one way by our boys, range too short, and another by Fritz, shoot me right now. The rocket men suffered because Fritz and us had the same rockets, so when one flare went up, it could be ours, could be theirs, could mean anything. 5. The runners were the backup boys when everything else had failed. Like being a cyclist, it sounded easier than it was, and like with us cyclists, it was the terrain that buggered them up. There was just no running through trenches and wires. 6. Dogs. Dogs just upset people. They were raring keen, but nobody liked to see ours hurt, and nobody wanted to shoot Fritz's. One corporal was killed trying to put an injured dog out of its misery. For a while, we had a good one of Fritz's we'd captured. Well, actually, he changed sides, basically. Big chap. He'd lost his message, useless dog, though he had his service number on his collar, and he came from Westphalia, but actually, he was anybody's for a bit of bully beef and a stroke, so we called him Kaiser Bill. 7. Pigeons. Sometimes they flew, sometimes they hid, especially if the weather was bad. Sometimes they were turned into stew. If the pigeons weren't clearly on our side, I thought, who could blame them? 8. Us cyclists. Not many of us went to France, and who knows what they were thinking of who sent us. A few were switched to stretcher bearing, but I thought of the others I'd known in training, still guarding the eastern defences of England on long, flat roads that roared like the sea as the tyres covered the miles and only the enemy, the wind.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Putting your characters, your lovely characters, because they're all lovely, your four men, putting them in jeopardy, it's a novelist's dream, isn't it?
I mean, yeah. I mean, that's what novelists do. In the First World War, I'm sure that's why so many people wrote about it. It's national, international jeopardy.
And it, as a reader, it gets you because you just know something nasty is going to happen. They're not all going to be end up safe.
Statistically, they can't. I mean, you know, I hadn't quite decided at the beginning who was going to make it, who wasn't. But I did have one thing where I'd written an episode. I'm making this up, and yet I'd managed to make myself really sad. And I go in, I've got a friend staying, and I'm also quite close to tears. And she said, "But you made them up. You decided a really nasty death. And now you're crying about it." Yeah, that's how sort of pathological novelists are.
That's the power, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the power.
Lovely. It's a wonderful book. Right, well, again, a slight diversion now. We're going to hear from Emily Winslow. Emily is best known as a crime writer. She's written three crime novels, all set in Cambridge. But last month, she published her memoir, Jane Doe January, subtitled My 20-Year Search for Truth and Justice. It details the attempts by the US justice system to indict the man who raped Emily 20 years ago, following the emergence of new DNA evidence. I started by asking Emily about that subtitle and what the words truth and justice mean for her.
The subtitle was actually a very tricky decision. It was my publishers who wanted a subtitle, and I think they were right. They wanted something more than just a memoir. We batted a lot of different ideas back and forth. The subtitles that I was proposing, which were not suitable ultimately, were things that were very distancing. I was saying like, oh, you know, I wanted DNA detectives and a cold case pursued after 20 years or something like that. Something that had me less at the center of it, which of course was not appropriate, but I think quite psychologically appropriate for me to be pushing for. When they finally settled on that one with the truth and justice, I'm happy with it. But it does feel a bit strange to me because when I was writing the book, I never felt like I was pursuing truth or pursuing justice with those big capital letters. I was pursuing very specific things. I wanted to put him in jail, and that's what I wanted. It had nothing to do with bigger things. It was all just small letters and very specific. I wanted to put him in jail.
But that's a definition of justice, I guess.
It is. And that's why the subtitle is fine. But from my point of view, that's never how I thought of it.
Yes, you'd stayed in touch with the sex assaults unit in Pittsburgh over those 20 years, hadn't you? You'd regularly been ringing in, checking in, seeing if there's any news and developments.
But it was always different detectives. There is very high turnover in that department. So I would call back, and the last person I'd spoke to will have moved on ages before, and I'd have to start over. They would have never heard of my case. They'd have to look it up. That was very disheartening.
When the case was reopened, you had to recall the events of 20 years ago. That must have been difficult in all kinds of ways, in very practical ways, as well as very emotional ways.
It was tricky trying to make sure that I was remembering correctly and precisely and not embellishing or summarizing or assuming after 20 years. I very carefully was writing down my memories as I remembered them. First I did that, and then I looked at the things that I wrote then. And plucked memories out of there and said, okay, yes, and that does fit with everything I've just checked. And then I got the police notes and I was able to add more from there and also, again, get confirmation that I was remembering things as they were. But it was a very strange experience just because a lot happens in your thoughts in 20 years and just trying to be sure that everything that I said on the stand was going to be strictly, strictly accurate, because if I exaggerated or embellished or just filled in some blanks just to be accommodating or to make it make sense, which is a very natural thing we all do when we're talking, if they could show that I was incorrect about that, then it could put my whole testimony into question.
And you mentioned there about writing. You found comfort in writing after the rape. Did you always feel that you would come back to it somehow in a longer exploration?
It's not something I wanted to come back to in a vague, general, I remember 20 years ago sort of way. And the book is very much about the prosecution and all of the action of that act and those 13 months. And I think without that holding it together, I wouldn't have wanted to pursue it just in a general, vague memory sort of way. I am glad there was the chance to write about it now.
And the book is also very much about the man who raped you, about Fryer, about your quest to find out more about him and about the details of his life. Why did you want to find so much out about him? You say in the book, I'm not sure people understand it. And it is quite puzzling.
It's so interesting because, yes, some people are utterly puzzled by it. And then other people say to me that they would have done exactly the same thing. You know, just writing about it at all, I think what I've found so helpful about that is it has helped me to be very specific about what I'm feeling and what I want. It's so easy to get caught up in what you think you're supposed to want or what you think you're supposed to feel. And writing is a way for me to just drill down and get very specific and figure out what's actually happening, not what is supposed to be or what I suppose anybody else is supposing I should be going through, both after the rape and during the prosecution.
You give a lot of your book over to Fryer, though, the details of his life.
Oh, yes.
I mean, how did that feel? Because he takes up a lot of page space.
It does. I mean, think about it. For more than 20 years, I had no idea who he was. He was just this force, this monster who just, you know, showed up and this happened and then he disappeared again. You know, in a lot of ways, being raped by a stranger is kind of a privileged position compared to acquaintance rape, because people who are dealing with acquaintance rape have to deal with a sense of having been betrayed by somebody they used to trust. They have to deal with their friends having to sort of choose who they're going to side with. I think there are a lot of extra stresses. With stranger rape, it's just very straightforward. He's a monster. He's evil. I've been done wrong too. And that's how it was treated by absolutely everybody from the start, by the police, by my college, by everybody around me. So in a lot of ways, that's comforting. But it also gives him a lot of power. It makes him almost mythical. And so being able to gradually discover specifics about his life, it just gradually chipped away and chipped away and chipped away until he's just another person. And that's much smaller and much less scary.
It was extreme detective work to find that information out, wasn't it? I mean, you are very determined in the book to see the case through, but also to find out as much as you can about him. You're on Facebook pages, you're trawling all kinds of records about him, speaking to people at all the places that he's lived and speaking to penal institutions.
I did everything that I could that was either online or by telephone or by letter, but I promised myself I wouldn't interact with him or any of his family and that I wouldn't insert myself into his life in any way. This was all done from a distance, quite deliberately. As I wrote the whole book, I was sharing it with people as I was writing it. It's just the way I communicated what was going on. And I remember it was just because I'm a writer and this is the kind of thing I worry about. When people were reading that section, I was like, is that kind of boring compared to the section about the hearing, which was more, you know, exciting and involved police and a judge and, you know, going to Pittsburgh and all of that. And they said, no, it's not boring because... I hope it's not impolite to say, but you seem kind of obsessed and obsession is interesting. And I'm like, oh, okay. Yes, I probably am obsessed at the moment. But it was actually a relief. When I found out everything I wanted to know, then it did kind of come to a close. I think if I were still Googling him, that would be a problem.
And of course, your book is out there now. For all you know, he could be reading it.
I would be very happy if he never even knows about it. That would be the way I would like it to go. I did consider using a pseudonym for him. There were a lot of reasons why I eventually decided not to, but the primary one was simply practical. He had already been named in the news reports, so it's not like it would actually prevent anybody from knowing who he is. But yeah, it would be my wish that he never, ever knows about it. And certainly if he does, I don't ever want to hear from him.
And you considered using a pseudonym for him. Did you ever consider using a pseudonym for yourself?
No, never, 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 never. I'm a writer. This is what I do. That's not a problem.
And you're a crime writer. Do you think you would have become a crime writer had this not happened to you?
I don't know. I've been trying to work this out. I remember being in my hometown library in New Jersey and reading all the serial killer books and finding them very interesting. And I can't remember if this was when I was a teenager in high school, which would have been before the rape, or if this was when I was in graduate school and I had moved back home for graduate school, which is after the rape. And I honestly don't know if I became interested in crime stories in a way because of the rape, or if it's just something I've always been interested in. I mean, let's face it, crime stories are very popular. You don't have to have been involved in a crime to find crime fascinating, to find it to be a very practical plot engine, to find it to be an exciting puzzle. I do like to think that perhaps I have more depth in certain aspects because of my experiences.
Well, you've been very candid about it, and you said that the rape made you a better writer.
Oh, absolutely, because there's a self that one wants to present, not only when saying things about oneself, but in about how one views the world. And it shook my ideals a bit in a way that I think is very healthy and made me more compassionate towards myself, towards others, just about weakness and fear and anger and struggling and all kinds of things. I mean, I think it's made me a better person.
That's a very challenging thing to say, isn't it? I mean, it's quite difficult to hear.
Well, I think you can achieve that without having to go through this. Let's wish that for everybody.
And in terms of writing the book, it is very detailed about the process that you went through. Were you keeping notes as you were going along?
I wrote it as I went along. This is exactly, you know,
so
obviously,
all those emotions are as you're feeling them at the time. It does feel like that. It feels very visceral.
Absolutely. Once I would capture an emotion properly and I'd say, oh, that's it. That is exactly what I'm feeling right now. Then it kind of allowed me to move on to whatever emotion was next. It just enabled me to sort of just go through each one and, I don't know, let it go maybe. It's acknowledged, it's preserved, and then I can go see what's next.
Because there's two processes at work when you're reading the book, definitely. There's the procedural process mm-hmm. that's gone through and the process of you writing it down and reflecting. You're a different person, it seems to me, at the end of the book than you are at the beginning, and that's not just down to what happened in a courtroom.
Right. And it was so not that long ago. The prosecution was only 13 months, and it ended October 2014. So that's a year and a half ago. So yes, probably I am a different person from the end of the book, but I will leave that to others to describe. I don't really know. I think I'm too close.
That's Emily Winslow there talking about her memoir, Jane Doe, January. You're listening to Bookmark. Studio guest Elizabeth Speller also listening to that with me. We are coming near to the end of the show, unfortunately, but talking about memoir there. You yourself have written a memoir, The Sunlight on the Garden, a memoir of love, war and madness. Is that yes. subtitle? What prompted you to write that?
I think partly because I had inherited all this fantastic stuff. Well, not inherited, I sort of stolen when I was a child things that interested me and then acquired material. And also when I was 30, I had a very sort of very major breakdown and was in hospital. And my grandmother had been, I suppose, bipolar most of her life and had been in Alpha, and there was this horror that this might be my life. It wasn't. It was a one-off terrible year. Never returned, and I started looking and seeing, is there a line in my family? And as I say, eventually my nephew killed himself, and there clearly was a problem with people who'd had problems with mental health, but they were all actually sort of interesting, creative, and happy. But I mean, happy people with just this occasional shadow. So I started off on that, and actually it was sort of quite funny. I probably wouldn't have written it if my mother was still alive. She died at 60, so. And my father was going blind, and he does know this. I said to my sister, can he still read? And she said, no, he really can't read. I said, that's fine, I'll write this. And then he rang me up and said, I've got corneal transplants. It's fantastic. I'm going to Moorfields. And sort of it's so solipsistic. I was going, oh, my God, he's going to read my book. Not, oh, my father is going to see again. Which this is my first reaction. But all he's going to discover is me either trying to lose my virginity or truanting. Or, you know, and you're a great grown-up person. You don't want them to read about that bit of your life. So, it was good. I mean, again, it got some things off my chest. But it's highly selective. People say, well, how could you write about, you know, things that seem very intimate to them? Well, it's, you know, a hell of lots not in there. I thought very carefully what I exposed. Because I've got children. And just 18 months ago, you know, when various men in their 70s start getting into trouble, famous men, for sort of being predatory on young women, I had put an episode in there and I described an actor, I described the place he lived. I was very careful not to name names or give. Two newspapers rang me.
Oh, really?
And
really?
And asked me.
And, yeah. They're on it.
So they're on it because it's fashionable.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You have to be careful.
Well, it's been lovely talking to you, Elizabeth. I know you're busy writing your next novel, so you must come back in because there's loads of questions here that I've got on my book that I haven't asked you. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. We'll come back to your last choice of music in just a moment. You can talk us through that. But just to highlight the next show that's coming up, our studio guest then is Bea Wilson. She's a food writer and she'll be talking about her latest book, First Bite, How We Learn to Eat, which is exactly that. It looks at what shapes our eating habits. We'll also be hearing from Edel Hopkins. She is a bookmaker, literally a maker of books, and talking to hypnotherapist and therapist Ali Knowles about her series of books for children, Ollie and His Superpowers, which are published by Jessica Kingsley. If you want to listen to any of the old bookmarks, I always refer you to the Cambridge 105 website, cambridge105.fm, and all our shows are there from the beginning of time, if you wanted to go that far back. But we'll sign out now with your last choice of music, Elizabeth, which is a lovely track. I've not heard this before. This is Wahabibi from the Cronus Quartet. Why this one?
Partly because I had children very young and came to Cambridge very late. I came at 39. And one of the reasons I came, I travelled masses in the Near Eastern Turkey. And I used to sit on the hillside and think, well, what am I going to do in my life? And I thought, I'll come to Cambridge and read classics. And so it went. But also I wrote about Hadrian, emperor. There was no music for his life to sort of inform me. But this bit of music just made me think about his travels in Judea, as it was then. And it's a beautiful Lebanese, long, ancient Lebanese folk song.
It is beautiful. Yes, thank you. And it's from a particular album, Floodplain.
From Floodplain, who quite a lot they also do sort of Serbia and things, but taking songs from all kinds of areas, almost all of which have seen terrible troubles. And it's a thing of peace and beauty. And for me, that part of the world is very attractive.